I'm Chris Benda, theological librarian at Vanderbilt University's Divinity Library, and I'd like to welcome you to another in a series of conversations about recently published or forthcoming books by faculty in Vanderbilt University's Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion. Today I'll be talking with Robin Jensen, Luce Chancellor's Professor of the History of Christian Art and Worship, about her recent book, Living Water: Images, Symbols, and Settings of Early Christian Baptism. Robin, thank you for being willing to take part in this interview.
Thank you for having me.
Great. Well, we'll start right in. Your book is based on your doctoral dissertation. And I was wondering, why did you select baptism of all of the things that you could have selected for this major first major research work that you did?
And it's funny because it was now, 20 years ago. So it's sort of odd to be talking about this now after so much time, and it just, other things happened in the meantime. Other books got published, and this one never did. But I remember those negotiations with my then doctoral dissertation director, who is an art historian by the name of Richard Brilliant at Columbia University. And he really wanted me to write on water in religious ritual in the ancient world. The funny part is, after I sent him this book back in January when it came out, he wrote to me and he said, "Now you should write that book on water in religious ritual in the ancient world." And I thought to myself, I am never going to write that book, because I realized it would be impossible. It would be like trying to write a 7-volume dictionary or something. So, but it sort of began with him, I think. And I also began because I was working with him on early Christian iconography, especially in the Roman catacombs, and I wasn't the first person to think this, but it was really clear to me, or at least I thought, that I agreed with anyone who would say that the images in those tomb paintings, they are burial places for early Christians, was largely focused on sacraments, on Christian sacraments. But the more I looked at them, I thought they had an awful lot to do with baptism in particular. So that I would see images that others would see as representing just narrative stories from the Hebrew scriptures, like Noah or Jonah, I would understand them to be symbols or typologies or figures of baptism. And I think it had a lot for me to say, why then is baptism, why is funerary art so keyed to things that would be symbolic of baptism? And that sort of took me into, what does the baptismal ritual do? And one of the things that I understand it to do is to sort of guarantee or give the promise of resurrection from death. So it made sense to me that people would put it on their tombs. It's kind of like, you know, we have a contract here, God. So I'm going to remind you that I've been baptized. And so there's these images of baptism. Mm-hmm. And that's how it kind of got started.
A kind of a ground-clearing question, although a huge question. And you've alluded to at least one, or you've mentioned at least one one definition or reason about what baptism was at the time. What is baptism at that time? What is baptism in the first 6 centuries? It's a huge question.
It's a huge question, but it's really a good one, because in a way, these projects have kind of stacked up now that this one is out. I have a new book coming out in, I would say probably about 6 months should be out, on what baptism means. And I've divided it up into sort of themes, it very much is like this book, but different in that it really looks at the question you just asked. Mm-hmm. And one of the themes that I pick up, and I think is a very early understanding, even in the New Testament, is that baptism is purification. It's cleansing. It removes sin. It shows repentance from sin. And that would be almost what you would see in John the Baptist's call to baptism in the Synoptic Gospels. But baptism also comes to mean incorporation in Christianity in a way that a purification bath didn't really mean quite that in Judaism. So it comes to be an initiatory ritual. And in that way, it has some parallels with initiation rituals in other religious traditions, especially Roman and Greco-Roman religious traditions. So one is incorporated into a community. And by being incorporated, then can attend the other religious rituals that belong to that community. So it's kind of the gateway, the gateway ritual. And there's a lot of thinking about how one is now a flock, a member of the flock, or a part of the team, a cohort, a soldier for Jesus. And then the third thing that I talk about in this other project is baptism as illumination, as the imparting of special knowledge and wisdom. Through the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which is part of the ritual, though not necessarily part of the water bath. It might be, it might not be. And a fourth thing that baptism kind of does or creates or effects is regeneration. So we have this whole idea, even in the New Testament, whether you look at the Gospel of John, where Nicodemus says, well, do I have to go back into my mother's womb to be reborn? So the whole idea of dying and being reborn, which is picked up then in the epistles, obviously earlier than John, but in, say, the epistle to the Romans, where you participate in Christ's death and resurrection through baptism. So dying, being rising again. And the last thing that I see it meaning and doing is kind of a recreation of the original creation. It's a restoration of Eden, and the ones who are baptized become Adam and Eve, but before the fall. So it's kind of an ecological and eschatological even ritual. So it's very layered. It means a lot of things. It might not mean all of those things all the time. It might mean two or three of those or some other things too that we could throw into the hopper, but I try to keep it simple as best I can.
As you've already mentioned, some of your approach to or your interest in baptism partly came out of your going into catacombs and looking at paintings. And the approach in this book is very deliberately to start with the visual representations of baptism, and then going to the text, the documentary evidence. Why this approach, how did you come about this approach?
As a graduate student, I wasn't ever sure where I belonged. I'm probably still not sure where I belong. You know, you're interviewing me in an art history office, and I teach as well in the Divinity School, and now, you know, some religious studies overlap into the graduate department, and one of the things that I chose to do was to try to use as my database or as my source of historical information, material culture, visual representations, paintings, even architecture. And so in a way, it's not so much that I think it's the only way to do it or the right way to do it or a better way to do it. It's the way I do it. Mm-hmm. and I think it's important that we help other scholars and students to understand that religion and theology and understandings of faith or God are not just expressed in texts, but we have them in these other forms, whether they're visual art or other kinds of expressive liturgy, ritual. So I've always been interested in expanding the ways that we might know things about religion. And within Christianity, I mean, I think other religions are more, scholars of other religions are often better at this than scholars of Christianity or historians of Christianity. So it's something that I hope I can bring to the field. So I start with it because other people would start with text. I'll start with the art.
let's turn then to the text, to your book, and kind of go through it. And obviously, you know, the listener will need to read the text. We're not going to go through all of the
details.
It does
have words, yeah.
That's right. And it does have a lot of pictures, too. And we're not obviously not going to be able to cover everything. But what I wanted to do over the next hour is talk a little bit about some of the things that struck me as I was reading it, some of the things I had questions about. So we're just kind of picking things out and talking about them. You start with the catacomb paintings.
Right.
And one of the questions that I had as I was reading the chapter about the catacomb paintings was, who created these paintings? For whom did they create the paintings? And who was the audience? I mean, these are burial spaces, so who was... I don't know enough about catacombs, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to shed some light on them.
Well, very briefly, mm-hmm. Most of the paintings that we have in the Roman catacombs are from the 3rd and 4th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them are in Rome, although there are catacombs in other parts of the world with some art, but the sort of the epicenter where the whole largest amount of them is in Rome. And they weren't just for Christians. Beginning in the 2nd century, lots of people buried in these kinds of cemeteries that were excavated galleries and what we call hypogea, so underground mausolea or rooms in which families could be buried. So we would see, we say pagans, a great word, but I'll use it anyway. Mm-hmm. Pagans, Jews, Christians all used this form of burial. Christians tended to bury together, we think, although there are certainly exceptions to that. Families might have been mixed. Not everybody in the family was Christian, so we might have a mixture of burials. And so it isn't just that Christians weren't the only ones doing this. But when you go to Rome and you go to visit the catacombs, mostly they're going to take you to see the Christian catacombs. It's a sort of Roman pilgrimage site. And there's a lot of them. And what would happen is that people would have, if they had the means, and does tell us something about the economic viability of Christianity at the time, before it was even a legal religion, people had the means to have these decorated with paintings. Like, they might have had their homes decorated. I mean, we don't necessarily have to think it's different from altogether from what they would have painted on their dining room walls. But they would decorate these tombs, and they would come to visit them. I mean, it wasn't that you buried grandma and you never went back. I mean, these are places that people would come back to celebrate the festivals of the ancestors, to have meals with the dead, to honor and remember their family members, and then eventually the saints who were also buried in these places. And so we would see them be decorated, and then the question you asked about who would do that, I mean, for whom? And I suppose we have to think about at least a middle class, an upper middle class social status. We don't have any artists' names, so we're talking about workshops, and I don't know that you'd have to assume that they were all Christian workshops, working only for Christians. So you went to your local catacomb painting shop and you ordered your decorations for your family tomb. And with that, you get a kind of standard catalog of images. There's not a huge variety. And they're all different. There are no two that are exactly alike, but there are real patterns and you can see categories of paintings. So some particular images are very much more popular than others. The Good Shepherd is hugely popular, as is Jonah. Old Testament figures, Daniel, and so forth. What I focused on in this book that we're talking about is mostly depictions of baptism, whereas in the book that I just finished, I'm talking about those depictions which refer to or allude to baptism in my theory. And so what I was looking here is at the way that the ritual was depicted. And mostly, I think, what we see is an image of Jesus being baptized by John the Baptist.
That's what we have in these, a lot of these, not exclusively, but we have in a lot of these catacomb paintings, a picture of a small male sort of child or youth, and a larger male standing next to the child, and the child is standing in some body of water or something, and the larger male has his right hand on the child's head. And what's going on here?
and that small child figure is nude, too.
Yes, that's right.
Which is also
right,
really
exactly.
very
yeah,
it's
exactly.
very interesting.
Yeah.
And so one question is, how can I say that's Jesus, mm-hmm. right? Because we don't think Jesus was a child when he was baptized, at least not according to the text that we have. He would have been around 30 years old, and so wouldn't look like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that is one of the things I try to puzzle out and talk about, is that why would we show Jesus as being a small person, not necessarily a little baby, but something between 4 years old and 8 years old or something, certainly at least pre-adolescent, and why nude? But the tall figure is also part of the clue to the whole story. The tall figure often is shown in an animal skin, standing on a rock. There's very often a dove in the image. It's ordinarily a dove, but not absolutely always. And so if you interpret that tall person as John the Baptist, you don't really have much option, I think, you know, except that's probably meant to be Jesus. And what I think happens is that what we're saying is that it's like a simulacrum or something. In baptism, this figure is everybody. Mm-hmm. Jesus is, in a sense, anybody who's being baptized, and anybody who's being baptized is put into that moment in which this whole ritual has been inaugurated. And so in one way, it is both Jesus and the one who and the ordinary human person. And it's the same way that John the Baptist is at one and the same time John the Baptist and the bishop who's administering the ritual. And so it's kind of a dual image, and it's sort of, I think, what it says is that baptism is a return to the state of childhood innocence, and that even Jesus, in participating in that, was somehow incorporated or returned to a kind of childlike state. Baptism is a regeneration, and so it's a kind of funny thing, but it's not a precise, as art never is, I think, a precise illustration of a text.
Mm-hmm.
It's already interpreting a text. It's telling us something about what that text means in a context. So.
Am I right in thinking, too, that you arrive at the idea that this is John and Jesus from the context, the contextual images in these catacombs as well? I mean, all the various stories from... Mm-hmm. the Old Testament or from Jesus' life? I mean, is that sort of a contextual clue to...
Well, it's the first way we know that it's... Yes, we have to say it looks like a Christian baptism. Mm-hmm. Now, that does... Right now, there's a whole lot of information in that right now. We'll come back to that. You know, why is his hand on the head and what's going on with that? But it will be surrounded by other images, say, people sharing a meal, or the images of Noah, the Good Shepherd. So we say it was not a Jewish catacomb. In fact, there are some Jewish catacombs in Rome that have figurative art, but not a lot. We're in a Christian context. We see a Christian narratives that have to do with what is meaning here. And so baptism is part of that meaning. Noah appears nearby, perhaps, to also say that Noah was baptized. The flood is a form of baptism, and the early church writers understood it that way. They read the Hebrew scriptures, or what they had in Greek translation, and they mined those stories for prophecies or prefigurations of Christian rituals, sacraments, events, historical moments, and saw, as you even see that in the New Testament, of course, they'll say this was to fulfill the prophecy of so-and-so. So I think we need to read all of those things as being a kind of prefiguration and or typology or a way of reading it symbolically.
Mm-hmm.
And once you start opening that up, you do have to see the whole context. I mean, you do have to sort of put it all together.
Right. You mentioned this earlier, but I wonder if you could develop a little bit. You talk about the catacomb paintings. You talk about sarcophagi.
Mm-hmm.
So what's baptism and death? I mean...
Yes. Well, baptism is death.
Yeah.
baptism is death and new life. I mean, the first thing that baptism is a death to the old self. And we have that sort of writ large, I think, across Christian theology, but early Christian theology, and even in the New, Testament, that by undergoing baptism, you die to a former self, maybe a sinful self, a person of a different identity, and you are reborn into a new identity. You're given a name, a new name, maybe you have a new clothes, and the process is to go into a grave, a watery one, and emerge from a womb. And so a baptismal font is one and the same time, a tomb and your mother's womb. You can think about Nicodemus talking to Jesus and John here at that point. And that image is very much picked up in the writing, early Christian writings. I'm not making this up. It's not even just in the art. It's all over the text. And so there's a sense of course, you emerge from your mother's womb as a naked child. So again, we have a small naked child being baptized. And so I think that all makes sense. But why? And then you see, on top of everything else, we're in a tomb. We're in a real tomb, not just, you know. And what I think, because in baptism, a Christian understands that they are promised resurrection, that they now really have died to this world, and they really intend to be, or anticipate being resurrected to the next one. So I think baptism and death are pretty closely linked.
We'll likely come back to a little bit more about the way that baptism happens, in a sense, the movements through the process. But what I wanted to do first was kind of go through a little bit more of your book and raise a couple of other things that I found interesting. One thing that was particularly interesting to me in a chapter that you have on baptismal iconography and ivory, glass, and mosaics, which covers a vast amount of material, so it would be difficult to summarize, but a particular thing that I found interesting was your discussion of these two mosaics in these two baptistries. One is an Orthodox baptistry and one is an Arian baptistry. And what I was wondering is, first, what were the differences for folks in the audience who aren't necessarily aware of what Arian theology was? What are the differences between Orthodox and Arian theology? And then, to what extent do the mosaics represent those kinds of differences? And is there anything in line with your discussion in the book that we can learn from the images, sometimes things different from what we see in the text? Is there anything in those images that tells you something about Orthodox or Arian theology that we wouldn't necessarily get in the texts? A lot of questions.
And let me back up, so I'll start describing these. These are both from the 5th century, one more toward the beginning, perhaps, and one more toward the end. They could be 50 to 75 years apart. The first one that we see is certainly the model for the second one. So that's the first thing to say. And they're both in Ravenna, and the first one, which was built for to be a baptistry for the cathedral before the Arians got to town, and I'll tell you how they got there, has an awful lot of iconography in it. But at the very apex of the dome, which is directly over the font, this is an octagonal building that's centralized with the font in the middle, and the dome is directly overhead. And so an individual standing in the baptismal font would look straight above and see this dome image, the small medallion that's in the top of the dome of John the Baptist. And this is very clear now. It's Jesus as an adult being baptized. And John the Baptist is standing on a rocky ledge. Jesus is in a river. Jesus is nude. It's very clear that Jesus is nude. And there are a figure in the water on the other side is a personification of the Jordan River, which is interesting in itself. Sometime later, the city was governed or in some sense taken over by an Ostrogothic ruler by the name of Theodoric. And the Ostrogoths were Christians, but they were Arian Christians and not Orthodox Christians. And they had their own cathedral. He built them their own cathedral, and they had to have their own baptistry because they didn't go to church with the Catholics or the Orthodox. So we have two competing Christian groups. And they, in decorating their baptistry, they almost certainly modeled it on the one that was down the street that belonged to the Orthodox. And so you see a similar composition of Jesus in the water being baptized with John the Baptist. Jesus is nude. The Jordan River appears in this, but in a slightly different way. Both of these images are ringed by processing apostles carrying crowns, their crowns of martyrdom, presumably. But in terms of the two depictions of Jesus' baptism in these two different places, there are a couple of distinct differences. One of them is that in the older one, the earlier one, Jesus is bearded. He looks older. He has a kind of more mature body, if you can say that. It's more muscular. And in the Arian, the newer version, he's not bearded, or if he is bearded, he has only a shadow of a tiny little wispy beard. And he has a more pudgy, kind of just post-adolescent body. And now, one has to account for the possibility of changes over the centuries. There have been some restorations. We're never exactly sure what these things really looked like when they were built. But if we kind of go with this, it's more or less accurate. We see, I would say, that one of the differences is that you see Jesus being made more youthful in the Arian baptistry. And I think I'm probably the only person that said this, but I'm pretty sure I'm right. That was a deliberate, there was something that made them do that. And one hunch that I have is that in Arian theology, Jesus isn't yet fully divine at his baptism, whereas in the Orthodox theology, he's fully divine from the moment of his incarnation or his conception. So you can sort of see this playing with, yeah, we can't make him look. And so what he grows in an Arian theology, he grows into his divinity. And it may begin at the moment where we talk in the Gospel of John about the Book of Glory, where he suddenly begins in the scene shifts from the Book of Signs, beginning at the beginning of the Passion, to the Book of Glory. And he may at that point become fully into his divinity. That's implied in the Gospel of John. So it's what I would want to argue, and I think it's controversial, but I'll still argue it, is that the Arians may be operating with a kind of Johannine Christology, in which he is in his ministry, in his youth and ministry, not fully in his glory. And this is only the evidence for this argument that I'm making, actually, in addition to this baptistry, is in the Arian, it's the Arian Palace Cathedral, in which we see the same thing happening in the iconography, where Jesus suddenly, all through his ministry, doesn't have a beard, and then suddenly at the Last Supper grows one. Anyway, that's kind of complicated, but I think one could make a case for seeing something happening there.
I thought it was kind of interesting to see these competing sort of theological arguments carried out in a visual way, not in a documentary way. It's kind of interesting. After you've dealt with discussed, presented all of these visual representations of baptism, you then turn to saying, "Okay, now what do we see when we compare them with what people were saying in the documentary evidence?" Mm-hmm. And you cover a variety of different matters, where baptism took place. how it was conducted. You know, was it immersion, effusion, aspersion? you know, who's involved in the rites? The whole issue of nudity in baptism, the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. You cover those things and others. You know, obviously we can't look at all of these things right now, but I wanted to ask sort of a general question that maybe will bring some of these things in. Baptism was represented in iconography in the documentary text for different reasons, mm-hmm. I guess, at various purposes. So how do you, in what ways do you see the purposes leading to some of the different purposes that the texts and the images had, leading to some of the similarities and differences in the way that baptism is represented iconographically and documentarily? I mean, that's a huge, it's like the kind of question you ask at, you know, to your students for a final exam or something.
Well, I think I'm right. I think okay. You're saying, are there differences between text and image, or is there something that the image is telling us that the text might not be saying, or are there?
Well, I'm wondering if, to what extent do the different purposes that the texts have versus what the imagery had might lead to some of the differences that you see between the texts. I mean, I am assuming that the texts mm-hmm. were written for various various purposes, polemical or education, for educational purposes. I don't.
Right. Well, there's, and one of the things that may help to sort of say this. Sometimes, mm-hmm. as we talked about, we see images of baptism in a tomb. And we mm-hmm. kind of talk about why it might be there. And then we sort of move in, and then as well as catacombs, we see those on those sarcophagi, you know, so mm-hmm. people's marble coffins that they bury themselves in, but there's still going to be baptism there. And then I kind of do shift to baptism in other contexts mm-hmm. than tombs, and so non-funerary contexts. Mm-hmm. And one of the places that we described, we see them actually depicted. Jesus' baptism actually depicted in a baptistry. Hmm. So it's a place where people underwent baptism and not where they were buried. And I think in those places, and it's an interesting thing in itself to think of what is a baptistry and when did we start having those. When I say that to somebody who's from the Church of Christ or a Baptist, they think I mean what I would now call a baptismal font. Mm-hmm. So I'm talking about a freestanding building or a special room or a chamber that's attached to a church in which people went into only for the purpose of baptism. And it wasn't a room that would have been otherwise used for, we don't think, for much religious ritual. It was a specified place and restricted pretty much to baptism. And so one of the things I try to look at is how we decorated those spaces. And so what other things are in there? And what was the function of that decoration? How did the iconography, in many cases mosaic now, beautiful, glorious medium, much better really to look at than catacomb paintings. and how did it create an environment that spoke to the person who was undergoing the ritual or imparted information about what the ritual meant? And so one of the things that you see is, for example, an awful lot of candles and birds and flowers and fruit and overflowing dishes, processing saints, shepherds with sheep and flocks, deer coming to waters, thinking of Psalm 42. So I think it's a kind of visual catechesis. Hmm. The candidates for baptism probably wouldn't have been in. We don't know, but I don't have any evidence that they were brought into these spaces until the day came that they were actually going to be baptized. And so I think there's some way in which they're surrounded by everything that they've learned that baptism's going to be. Rebirth, renewal, a new creation, new Eden. There's birds and fruit and flowers. It's a garden. It's glorious. In the center of it all, at least in one case, or the two we described, is Jesus' baptism. Another one I can think of is our starry skies, night skies with emblazoned crosses, wreaths of victory, It's a kind of, it's a kind of a great, beautiful shout of hallelujah, really. And I think that's different. That's different than what you would get with someone in a polemical argument about baptism. We're not arguing about what it is. We're showing you what it means.
Okay. You note in the book that baptism, the way that baptism is represented differs from place to place. It differs over time. It differs from the particular theological perspective that the creators of these images might have had. In a kind of a long view or a comparative view, how does the iconography of baptism, where does it end up at the end of the time period you're looking at, as opposed to where it's begun? I mean, what are the things that remain pretty much similar? What are the threads that run through, and then what are the things that change, and why? I mean.
Well, one thing that goes away is that little small child figure. By the 4th century, that one goes away. And I think by the 5th century, you have much more literal presentations, much more narrative links to the stories of John the Baptist baptizing Jesus. So as we see, Jesus becomes a grown-up. Well, at whatever age, he's either a 14-year-old grown-up or a 30-year-old grown-up, but he's still... and it's much more sort of literal presentation, I suppose, not quite so ambiguous about whether you're looking at a baby being baptized or Jesus being baptized or my being baptized or whatever. And so that kind of, that changes and shifts. And what we start to see as you work toward representations of baptism in later art, it's going to be mostly baptism of Jesus and be pretty much the same representation of John with Jesus, instead of the Jordan River, you end up tending to get angels on the sidelines. The Jordan River still kind of keeps showing up in the art, and only gets kind of under the water, and so it becomes standardized. That sort of funny, as I said, kind of ambiguous image that we saw earlier, kind of goes away. And then we do have much later images of historical baptisms, like, say, the baptism of Constantine or the baptism of Pippin or Charlemagne or somebody else. I mean, so, and you can even see it in like, the Wittenberg altarpiece and Luther's altarpiece, where we still see depictions of babies being baptized in the 16th century.
So, in a way, it's kind of a going back to what you see in the catacomb paintings. Almost. I mean, you don't have the ambiguity, perhaps.
It's almost more instructional, you know, and exegetical.
Yeah.
But if we think about those images of children being baptized, like, say, in the Wittenberg Cathedral, it's really helpful to my students, because I can say, look, they still have it's a baby, but they're still having, it's a naked baby, and they're going to immerse that baby. They're not sprinkling that baby. It's about to go into a swimming pool, practically. You know, it's more than a baby bath. So, so I think we do kind of get still a strong emphasis on the ritual. I think what might be interesting to say is that in a lot of Protestant and sort of more mainline Protestant denominations, baptism it may have lost some of that drama that it had in the early church, when you were baptizing adults at night, among a group, and they'd been prepared for some length of time, maybe as long as 3 years for this. They'd been fasting, they have been going without baths, without sleep, and it's a big deal. It's not sort of a simple christening to welcome a child into the family. It's a pretty big deal, and I think that changes over time. And I think the art reflects that change as much as the practices too.
You have already mentioned baptistries, which is another. I mean, you move from from talking about the images, the representations of baptism in iconography, and talking about those similarities and differences with text. And then you talk about sort of where do these things take place? What was the context of these baptisms? And you've already sort of alluded to this question. Why did these baptistries come into existence? I mean, if you believe the iconography, the early iconography, baptism was happening outside.
Right.
So, you know, why the move indoors? What led to that?
Well, and John the Baptist was clearly doing this outside.
Right.
So that was sort of the original form, I think. And I think we have pretty good reason to think that early Christian baptisms, as we see described in the Book of Acts, even in some of our earliest texts, say early Christian texts called the Didache, baptism is an outdoor ritual. So the question is, when and why did it move inside?
Mm-hmm.
The oldest extant or existing baptistry we have is dated to the middle of the 3rd century. It's in Dura Europis. It's today in Syria. It was there. It was excavated there. I think part of the answer to that is maybe there's several parts. One is baptism is a ritual in which people are nude. You might want to provide them a little bit of privacy, protect the modesty issue. Baptism was a ritual that was meant to be secret. I don't think it was meant for public view.
Mm.
And people wouldn't know what was going to happen to them until they were baptized. And so I think there's a sense of shrouding it in the mystery, as well as protecting the modesty of the candidates. And I suppose in some ways, especially before Christianity was a legal religion, it may have been practical to keep it out of the eye of the secular authorities. So I think that probably pretty early it moved inside into private baths.
Hmm.
And possibly atrium pools in people's homes. And we just don't know a lot about it. We have very, very sketchy evidence to say they might have used some public baths from time to time or other things. But I think all those reasons collectively, and then once people really, architecture's kind of nice, you know? We sort of like shows we're better than you. We have a fancier church and let's have a baptistry too. So the oddity is they keep building them long after they stop using them for baptism. I mean, or something like, you think of the Florence baptistry.
Mm.
I mean, it wasn't for those reasons anymore. But it's kind of a grand statement.
This might actually be the time to kind of go through the baptism process, because now that we're at the baptistry, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit in your answer to that question about the baptistry structure, you know, what it, they vary, of course, but, you know, what did they look like and what importance did the way that they were structured have, symbolic importance, talk a little bit about the font and, you know, what, so if you could kind of maybe walk through a baptism, I guess.
Well, I mean, first thing to say is that the baptistry, I'm going to speak of a baptistry as a building or a room,
okay.
And a font is the pool. That just clarifies to anybody who's confused of what I'm trying to talk about. There's a lot of variation from place to place, and so it's kind of hard to describe just the standard one. But in Italy, we very often see them as freestanding buildings that were octagonal in design and with vaulted, so a dome overhead, and interior columns supporting all of this. So it seemed to be all very focused on the center, and the center was the font. And the font itself could be octagonal in shape, big enough for a person to get in and at least kneel in water, if not get fully immersed. So we're talking not a little bowl of water, we're talking about some kind of pool. And the octagon itself, I think, is a significant shape, and it's interesting because many people still have octagonal baptismal fonts in churches. You roll the baptism, you know, take the font out and look at it, and it's going to be octagonal, and they don't know why, and it's very traditional shape. It goes all the way back to at least the 4th century as a sign that is an eighth, is pointing to the eighth day, which is the first day of the new creation. So the octagon is a very significant shape. In addition to that, because of their shape and their centralized and domed structure, they probably looked a lot like mausolea to people. So as you're approaching it, you're thinking, wow, this really looks like Grandpa's tomb or some emperor so-and-so's tomb. And it, in fact, is a kind of tomb. I mean, I think that the first significance to that. When somebody chose to be baptized, it was pretty much most of the time until later, 6th, 5th, 6th century, 7th century, it was primarily a ritual for adults. It wasn't baby baptisms happened, but they didn't happen as a rule, I don't think. And so people are prepared over some length of time for baptism. They may delay it until later in their life when they feel like they can go ahead and live a really good Christian life and not fall back too much into sinning. So sometimes people left it till their deathbeds because they knew they were going to keep sinning. And then it would usually be an event held in the evening. So it would be at the end of a long period of fasting and preparation, training and education, exorcisms, possibly going without sleep, certainly going without baths for some length of time. It was an ascetical preparation for this. The first thing that would happen is the candidate would be, now this is going to vary, and I'm going to give you a kind of an overview. This is the kind of hybridized version of a ritual that might come from a little bit from everywhere. But the person would be asked to renounce Satan and then swear allegiance to Jesus. And that might be followed by an exorcism and a stripping of all their clothes and a full body anointing with olive oil. Sounds kind of crazy, but they would do this. And I sometimes laugh and say, well, it kind of made them slippery because when they would get into the water, it would be harder for the devil to get to snag them, you know, like greased pig syndrome. But they would be, and we've got to also remember that Roman bathing practices were also to anoint a whole body. The oil was a form of soap. It kind of loosened the dirt. So oil is cleansing. It's also exorcistic. It can even be healing. And then once they've been anointed and they've been exorcised and they've renounced Satan and they're standing there naked and probably kind of embarrassed and kind of scared in the dark in these places, they would be taken to the pool and immersed 3 times and be questioned at each immersion whether they believed in the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And they would confess to that faith. That's where we actually get our creeds. We have the Apostles' Creed, for example, the Nicene Creed, were all interrogations at baptism. And so people would confess the Trinitarian faith, be dunked 3 times, come up out of the water. They would then be given something to wear, a new clean garment, which we now call an alb. It's an alb because it's white, and alba is the Latin word for white. So anytime you see those wonderful garments with the, you know, white linen garment, anybody who's baptized is authorized to wear such a garment. You can't wear a stole, but you can wear an alb. And then they would be, in some places, brought around to have their feet washed. The bishop would sometimes administer a foot washing. They would also have an imposition of hands, which we do see in the art. That's the one thing, that gesture that is almost consistent in the art, is the placing of the right hand on the head of the newly baptized person. And they might also be anointed with oil or signed with the cross as the gift of the Holy Spirit. So that's another part of the ritual, but it's equally important a part. This is a very complicated ritual. It's not just one thing. It's a lot of things. And then at the end of all of that, all of the newly baptized would probably be gathered together and perhaps given lit candles to carry and lined up and marched into the church where they would receive their first Holy Communion and probably greeted with loud cheers from the congregation. So it was a pretty long and complicated and probably kind of scary and sometimes uncomfortable ritual. Probably you wouldn't forget it very soon.
very a lot of sound and mm-hmm. and sensual sensation.
Very sensual.
Yeah. And another kind of this is sort of a question to close to closing, a penultimate question, I guess, that attempts to kind of bring some of this together or get at how your book is different in the way that it approaches baptism. If we only had the catacomb paintings, the sarcophagi, the ivory, the mosaics, the baptistries, mm-hmm. And we didn't have any textual evidence, what would we know about baptism? How difficult would it be to construct a picture of baptism?
Oh, I think it would be really hard.
Yeah.
And this is something that we have at least one instance of this I can think that, or at least a parallel instance I can think of, is that we don't have much that tells us about what the Mithraic rituals were of it. We know that there were grades of initiation in the cult of Mithras in Rome, which was sort of contemporary with Christianity. We have iconography that shows this figure slaying a bull, and we have zodiac around him sometimes, and sometimes the sun god appears and other figures. And trying to piece a ritual together from art can be pretty darn hard. I mean, so in some ways, my art historian colleagues kind of object at times to my using the text, but I have to remind them, if without the text, the text is also the part of the document that we have. Hmm. And what I'm interested in is how are they different from each other? How do they do, like you said, how do they do different things? They're not trying to accomplish the same thing. How do they disagree with each other? I mean, is there discontinuity in which the text says something, but I can't imagine how that could be real if I look at the space in which it should have happened. So there's an idealist kind of approach in the text, when maybe there's a kind of, well, let's look at it on the ground and see whether we can make that work. Finally, how do they illuminate each other? Mm. And so I think there's three ways to think about it. And I think what we get, because we have the text, and I'm really, really glad we have the text, and we'll probably get new text some days, but what we have is a more complete picture.
Mm.
And that's really what I'm trying to help people to see, is that most historians of Christianity are used to using the texts, mm-hmm. and only the texts, and or relying primarily on the texts, and I think what they don't have is the whole picture
mm-hmm.
that way.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned at the beginning that you have some other projects coming up, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about them.
Well, I did talk a little bit about the one that I've just finished, and another project that's related to this, and it's a really big, long-term project, and doing it with a group, is we're trying to catalog, do an English language catalog, probably a database, an online database, of baptistries in the ancient Mediterranean world. So baptistries from Egypt and Syria and Mesopotamia all the way to Spain and Gaul, and from North Africa up to Britain.
Wow.
That's a huge project, and it's got about, we've divided the ancient world into 15 regions, it's now 18 regions, we go between 15 and 18, and we try to have archaeologists from all those areas sending us information. As soon as we get our database system set up, we'll be able to start inputting data. So that's another related project. And similar to that, I'm working with my husband, who's also on the faculty of Patu Burns, and we're working on North African Christianity and the practices of Christianity in Roman Africa. And I've just finished a chapter for that on basilicas and baptistries in Roman Africa. So, and we, along with lots of other things like, Eucharist and marriage and burial, we're talking about baptism mm-hmm. there. So there's sort of ways in which all this kind of connects, and I'm probably someday going. And I don't write everything about baptism.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean, you really things. Were sent on a.
No, yeah, no. It's like looking back and thinking, how did I get into that? Now, I mean, I have other projects, but these are the ones that are sort of linked and related, and certainly provide good, what's the word I want, kind of, they're very illuminative of each other. Mm-hmm. So, I'm kind of drowning in it. Oh, that was really bad.
That was.
Well, I apologize for that.
I look forward to talking to you about all of these projects. So, again, thank you for this conversation. I've been talking with Robin Jensen, Luce Chancellor's Professor of the History of Christian Art and Worship, about her recent book, Living Water: Images, Symbols, and Settings of Early Christian Baptism, recently published by Brill. If you have any comments about this conversation, just browse to the homepage of the Vanderbilt Divinity Library and click on the Contact Us link at the bottom of the page. We look forward to hearing from you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you.